The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
From the crossroads of Merrick Avenue and Sunrise Highway in beautiful Merrick, Long Island, New York, this is WGBB Sports Talk New York. 95.9 FM, 1240 AM on your dial. I'm your host, Mike Wadone, joined as always by my co-host, the man we call Cappy, Chris Caputo. 516-623-1240 is the number here in the studio. Again, that's 516-623-1240. If you'd like to join us, we have a jam-packed show tonight. Author John W. Miller, who wrote The Last Manager, a story about the great Earl Weaver, is going to join us right away. And then we have John Santa Maria going to talk a little Islanders hockey, and then we're going to finish up tonight with Kenny Schroy, former New York Jet, to talk about the Marty Lyons Foundation. But before we get to any of it, Cap, how you doing?
Doing well, Mike. Good to see you. It's been a couple of weeks, but yeah. Nice to be back together. And I kind of look forward to these shows. It gives us
Absolutely.
A little bit of everything.
It really does. And we have some great guests tonight, and we're gonna lead it off tonight by welcoming in Mr. John W. Miller, who wrote The Last Manager: How Earl Weaver Tricked, Tormented, and Reinvented Baseball. Mr. Miller, welcome in. This is Mike Wadone and Chris Caputo here on Long Island. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, hold on. Sorry about that.
We had a little technical snafu there. Sorry about that.
You there, John?
Yeah, hold on.
Hey,
yeah, hi.
Hey, John. How are you? I'm sorry.
Hey, guys. Hi, Mike. Hi, Chris.
We lost you there for a second. Thanks for joining us tonight. You know, as we mentioned, you're the author of a fantastic book, which Chris and I both read, about Earl Weaver, called The Last Manager: How Earl Weaver Tricked, Tormented, and Reinvented Baseball. So we're going to ask you the obvious question. What was the impetus for this book? How did it come about? And, maybe fill us in a little bit of background on that.
Yeah, so I was for a long time a staff reporter at the Wall Street Journal, and I was not a baseball writer. I covered global trade and then global steel, and I was based in Pittsburgh covering the steel industry when Earl Weaver died. But I played college baseball in Maryland, and I'm an Orioles fan since birth, and I just knew a lot about the Orioles and about Earl Weaver. So they asked me to write his obituary for the Wall Street Journal.
Oh,
so
wow.
I wrote his obituary. This was 2013, and I'm writing the obituary. I'm thinking, man, this guy really did so much in baseball. He was the first manager to have a radar gun, first manager to use data in the dugout. And there hasn't been like a book that properly looks at where he came from, like what his origin story was. He's in the book Moneyball. He's in the book The Numbers Game, about the history of statistics in baseball. There's sort of like there's little tributes to him scattered throughout baseball history, but nobody had really explained who this man was and what his story was. And so that planted the seed. And then 8 years later, I decided to go for it and started reporting and wrote the book proposal, and then sold the proposal, and then there you have the book.
So, John, if you, some of the people out there, I think at this day and age, managers may not be the biggest thing on their mind. Can you give people a little bit of an idea of, we want people to go out there and find the book and read it, but give people an idea of who Earl Weaver was. Like, for the young people who maybe have never heard of him, give us a little bit of an idea of who he was and why you were so enthralled by him.
Yeah, so he was the Baltimore Orioles manager at a time when the Orioles were the best team in baseball over a period of about 15 years, from 1968 to 82. They went to the World Series four times under Earl, but six times over that period, won three of those. And he was sort of at the center of it. I mean, they were basically a bad franchise before he got there, and they've been mediocre since. So he's a unique example of a manager who was basically tied to one glory period of a team. And he was a cultural celebrity. He was on the cover of Time magazine. He was really famous at a time when baseball managers were more famous than they are today, not just in baseball culture, but in the wider American society. He was very well known, golfed with presidents, that kind of guy. And he was hilarious. He was a really funny character. I think you have to imagine like professional wrestling as a comparison here for younger listeners. He could, electrify stadiums with his ranting and raving. He would put his hat firm on his head and he called it beaking the umpires in the chest. He would play the part of the heel. He would fake a heart attack, and the umpire would say, "Weaver, if you're still alive, you're out of the game." He once tore up the rule book. He once had this profanity laden dialogue with umpire Bill Haler that it turned into a viral YouTube video or a viral video of the 80s where people would give each other bootleg copies, like 3.5 minutes long. And, you know, Ron Shelton, the film director who wrote the movie Bull Durham, told me he used that dialogue to write the script of the Bull Durham. So Weaver was a guy who he was a winner. He was entertaining. He was hilarious. He was very famous in the 70s. And he was also culturally significant. Like, they still call in baseball a three-run homer, they call that a Weaver. Anytime an umpire goes out or a manager goes out and fights an umpire, people reference Earl Weaver. You know, he helped design the first great baseball video game, Earl Weaver Baseball, which was made by EA Sports. And then EA Sports took that, and they made Madden Football. And so here you have Earl Weaver at the origin of, you know, the movie Bull Durham, Madden Football, the three-run homer. I mean, just like a wide range of influences from this one guy. And he was just really entertaining and colorful.
So I'm just going to pick apart the book a little bit. It's in five or so different parts. You have, you know, Dreams, a short thing about maybe him having a spat with Eddie Stanky. And then it goes on to St. Louis. And then it talks about part three, the Bushes. Part four is his time with Baltimore, and finally kind of how he became that famed person. What made you do it in that order? And talk a little bit about his life before Baltimore.
Yeah, so Weaver was born in St. Louis in 1930. He grew up in the Great Depression in St. Louis in a crowded street culture, a culture of taverns and bookies, was raised in large part by an uncle who's a mobster and a bookie. So he you know, grew up with this kind of street hustler's edge, street hustler sense of humor, you know, capacity to throw a punch. He lived next to a stadium, Sportsman's Park, that had two Major League Baseball teams, the St. Louis Cardinals and the St. Louis Browns. And so between April and September, there was baseball every day, Major League Baseball, every day of the year, a few blocks from him. He played high school baseball. He was an excellent high school athlete. He played what I guess now we'd call travel baseball, like a team that his dad put together that went and played other teams. They were very successful. They went 53-2. I saw newspaper clippings where they're you know, recruiting players, much in the same way. If you go on Facebook now, people are trying to get players for their son's team. That's what Earl Weaver Sr. did. And I theorize that that's why he was such a bad loser, because he went 53-2 for a team coached by his dad. So that'll turn you into a bad loser. But he was such a good player that he was signed at age 17 by the Cardinals and had four excellent minor league seasons before getting to a major league spring training and playing quite well. And he thought he deserved to make the team, and he didn't. And that really broke his heart and set him down this long path in the minor leagues before he got to Baltimore. But as I said in the book, he was such a great judge of talent because he knew the line between major and minor league talent because he was the line. He was the exact, you know, what they call now quadruple A player, who just knew like anybody better than him was a good big leaguer.
Again, we're joined by John W. Miller, who wrote the book The Last Manager, a story about Earl Weaver. And John, I got to ask you, you know, you had brought up, you kind of beat me to the punch. You brought up the viral, you know, video or audio of Earl arguing again with the umpire back in the 80s, and it really showed his character. But what it also did, it showed that he knew the moment. He was under, while he got thrown out of a game and was defending his team and defending himself, he kept going back, and then he would stop and he kept going back. So I would assume that, you know, you really kind of captured in your book, and I saw it from the read, that the theater part of baseball and managing was really important to him.
He was a showman, and he grew up in this era. So his dad did laundry for the Cardinals in the 30s, and the Cardinals in the 30s were a very famous team in baseball history. They're known as the Gas House Gang.
Yeah.
And they had their own cowboy band, and in the winter they would play the vaudeville circuit, so theater circuit in small towns, and they would play cowboy songs on the train. They would do stunts like plant a black cat in the opponent's dugout. So it was baseball as theater, and that's the baseball that Earl Weaver grew up watching, and that's the baseball he thought the fans deserved. And so he definitely, I mean, sometimes he would talk to tell the coach next to him, you know, watch this, and he would go out and he would have this fight with the umpire. And, you know, Ron Shelton, the Hollywood director, told me, he said, you know, Haller and Weaver, as soon as they start responding to each other's cues, they start, like, riffing off each other, it is theater. It's a place where they know their roles, and they are there to entertain. And I do think one of the points I make in my book is we have lost that because everything's taken so seriously now. There's so much money at stake.
Yeah.
Everything is so serious. And if you read like the quotes from the 70s and then the managers, I mean, they would say outrageous things in a way that was really funny. Like, you know, Weaver would say, you know, next time Billy Martin comes to town, you know, I'm going to deck him right in the teeth. and Martin would say, you know, that guy Weaver, you know, he's the best manager who ever finished third. I mean, just like talk trash all the time.
Yeah.
In a way that was really, it was fun. It was fun. It was part of the pageantry. I mean, you know, Weaver famously fought with his best player, Jim Palmer, for years, and they would have these arguments, and they would tell the reporters what they said to each other, and it was part of the entertainment, was the conflict and the tension was part of the humor and the drama.
So, John, you weren't even born in the United States, were you?
No, I was born in Belgium. My parents are from Maryland. They moved there to play music in the 1970s, so I grew up speaking French, but falling in love with baseball nonetheless.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, is baseball brings you back to that. I do want to get into something a little bit maybe controversial. You took the time to make sure you talked about Earl Weaver all over, you know, and, you know, some of the things, the heavy drinking, the chain smoking, the foul language, the umpire terror, like, you went into that. But also, at one point, I think I kind of got from Cal Ripken Jr. that he didn't want to talk about a lot of the reputation that Earl Weaver had. Can you talk a little bit about the protectiveness that Cal Ripken Jr. had when, you know, describing his manager?
Yeah, so that was very interesting. So most of the players would tell me stories. I mean, the stories are pretty shocking, frankly. Like, Tippi Martinez told me, he's a relief pitcher for the Orioles, he said on the plane Earl would drink so much he would pass out, and they would put a cigarette in his mouth and light it, and he would choke on the smoke and wake up. And part of the complexity and the interest in this question is, how could they play hard? How could he be a leader when he would disgrace himself like that? And so with Cal, I mean, I got a whole hour talking to Cal, which was great. And I sort of expected him to tell similar stories. But when we got to that, he just wouldn't do it. And you know, Cal is a different level of fame and different level of career than the other players in those teams. But it was also because Earl was family. I mean, Cal's dad was one of Earl's coaches for decades. And they went out drinking together. I mean, Cal Sr. also had a drinking issue and got DUIs. And he did tell me that they would go drinking at the bar and they'd have an argument, and then Earl would fire Cal Sr. at the bar. You're fired. And then the next day he would rehire him. And so, as Cal Jr. put it, you know, maybe alcohol had something to do with that. No, he wouldn't say anything, though. He wouldn't tell me. He said, I never saw cigarettes, never saw alcohol. And he was just protecting him because he was like family. And when Cal came up, he had this horrible slump. You know, he was 4 for 55 or something. And Earl basically, like, babied him a little bit, like really took care of him, really made sure he was talking to him all the time, encouraging him, and got him through this really hard, you know, first few months of his career where he had this horrible slump. And so Cal was always indebted to him for being almost like a father figure. And, you know, he said, I always saw the more empathetic side of Earl. And that's what's great about Earl, too, is that he's a complicated guy. Like, you have these, you know, fits of drinking and rage, but also this sweetness and kind of gentleness. And after the book came out, John Miller, the broadcaster, who's one of my heroes because we share a name partly, he called me. He called me to say how much he loved the book, and he said, uh-huh. You know, I was with Earl going through the Bronx one time, going to Yankee Stadium, and there were some homeless people, and Earl, the players were like making fun of them, and Earl shook his head and said, you know, but there before the grace of God go I, and I don't talk like that because that could have been me. And so he had this humility that came from his working class background that was very endearing, and I would hear these stories, and it kind of comforted me because I didn't want to spend 3 years of my life working on a book about a guy who was a total jerk.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I'm old enough to remember, I'm in my later 50s, Earl as a commentator on Monday Night Baseball and on the coverage of the World Series. Talk a little bit about that. You know, and did anybody kind of fill you in specifically about his later, you know, or even while he was still managing, doing some color commentary and things on baseball?
Yeah, so I listened to a lot of those games. And, you know, there's a one on YouTube. It's Earl broadcasting the Little League World Series, which is pretty funny thinking about that assignment, like assigning this crusty old chain smoker to cover Little League World Series. But he was not that great at it. He couldn't really let himself go. He was a very funny guy, but the humor was always interwoven with a lot of cussing. And so when he had to be clean and had to, like, play it straight, he was kind of wooden, formal, and it didn't really work. And so they let him go after a few years doing those Monday night games. But Al Michaels loved working with him, and Al Michaels said one time he saw him writing in a book after one of the gigs during the games, and he thought he was, you know, keeping score or something. And he asked Earl what he was doing, and Earl was writing down exactly how much money he had made that night, not out of greed, but because he was this depression kid who was always, terrified of going broke, terrified of running out of money. So he was always very frugal. He always saved cigarette coupons to, get like a free, table set or something. And in this case, he was, again, like writing down the money he thought he had made that night broadcasting the game. But they all loved working with him because he was such good company and so much fun to talk to after the game when they would go drinking at the bar.
We're talking with John W. Miller. The title of the book, The Last Manager, is that almost like a question or a thought process that maybe he was one of the last to do it his way?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously not literal. And it symbolizes the era when teams thought that you could turn a losing team into a winning team if you got the right manager. And nobody thinks that anymore. But back in the 70s, there was a big off-season acquisition when you would say, this year we're going to have Billy Martin or Earl Weaver or Dick Williams or Gene Mock come out, manage the team, and it's going to make all the difference. And so I say in the book he was, the king of managers at a time when managers were king. He's the only manager who was in the major leagues the 5 years before and after free agency arrived in 76. And that really, for younger listeners, that really changed everything because before free agency, managers were absolute dictators. I mean, their word was everything. You couldn't do anything if you were mistreated by a manager. You had to shut up or, quit playing baseball. Now you have an agent. You have all these people around you. There's a lot more focus or scrutiny of what managers do. So they can't be as dictatorial. Dave Roberts, who just won the World Series, he told me, in the old days, Weaver's days, the manager would say, it's my team, and now they say, it's our team. And so that quote, I think, symbolizes the title of the book because Earl Weaver was the last manager in the sense that he was symbolizes the last generation where managers were big stars in the game, sometimes bigger than the players, and had absolute control.
We talked to some people on here talking about Davey Johnson when he passed away recently and how he kind of brought about the numbers and the analytics. But that was something that Earl Weaver was into as well. Can you talk a little bit about maybe some of their similarities?
Yeah, so, I mean, they were both smart second basemen with wicked senses of humor, both hard to deal with. Earl's idea was, his sort of development was thinking that or recognizing the value of data on pitcher-batter matchup. So before Earl got there, you would never pinch hit for a good hitter. You just thought he'd be good against every pitcher. Earl recognized that sometimes even his best hitters had weaknesses against certain pitchers. And so his best example is that he had a slugging first baseman named Boog Powell, who was a 300 hitter and MVP. But against Tigers left-hander Mickey Lolich, Boog Powell was like 2 for 50. And so Earl's data showed him that he could pinch hit for his best hitter if he was up against his pitcher or bench him. And that had never really been done before. It seems obvious to us now, but
right. That
was a real innovation. And so he had these index cards he would have made with all these data points, and he would have them in the dugout. And so he was the first manager to have data in the dugout to make in-game decisions and pay attention to stuff like that. And his platoons were legendary. I mean, he had platoons where he'd have, one guy who's best against fastball pitchers, one guy best against curveball pitchers, and platoon them. He had these amazing innovations. Like, he had this idea of having his best pinch hitter lead off the game, thinking that, he's worth just as much in the first inning as in the ninth inning, so why not lead him off the game and then put in the shortstop who's a terrible hitter, Mark Belanger, in that spot in the order. And he was always innovating, always thinking of new ways of managing, trying to win baseball games. And that kind of braininess, I think, is something that is a precursor to Billy Beane and the Moneyball generation.
John, it's really, the book is a great read, and you got some amazing praise from, George Will, who is a fantastic author in his own right, Ken Burns, who did the baseball documentary series. When you were doing this book and started, did it take you any avenues that you hadn't anticipated as you were doing the research and talking to people? Or, was there anything that really surprised you, or, you said, wow, I got to really go down this road?
Yeah, in a good way, because, at the Wall Street Journal when I was there, like, we never wanted to do stories that had already been done, so I approached it that way. There's already been a lot written about Earl, and I knew the book wouldn't work unless I found some new stuff, and I was, obviously a little bit worried about that or skeptical and thinking maybe I won't find new stuff, but when I realized that, in Earl's own memoir, he talks about the influence of his uncle, and then you start doing research in the newspapers and finding out his uncle Bud was a gangster who beat up a former prosecutor and congressman whose first wife died of gas asphyxiation. The cops showed up, and he told the cops she had committed suicide. His second wife, he shot her in the hip. I mean, a nasty, violent guy. And that's Earl's uncle, who's like, you know, taken to 100 games a year. And so you start like filling in this picture of the world he grew up in. And then it just became infinitely fascinating, learning about this world that is, you know, so interesting and is gone now, 1930s, 40s St. Louis. Gambling culture, I had no idea that bookies were at every baseball game in the 30s and 40s. I mean, Major League Baseball likes to pretend that gambling went away between the Black Sox scandal and Pete Rose, and nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, there was gambling every baseball game in baseball history, probably. In the 40s, they had prop bets. You could bet on pitch counts. You could bet on the same stuff that, you know, Emmanuel Classe is in trouble with the Guardians now. You could bet on that stuff in the 40s, too, through people like Earl Weaver's uncle. So that world of gambling, I didn't know anything about that. I didn't realize Earl was such a good player, that he'd almost made the major leagues. There's all these little threads I could pull on that developed new material. I mean, that's why I was able to do the book at all, because I wouldn't have done it if it had been just, you know, recycling the same 10 stories that everybody always tells about Earl Weaver.
In the book, if you want to read a book, this is a good book to read. You don't have to be a Mets fan, a Yankees fan, a Pirates fan, an Orioles fan. You know, Earl Weaver did a lot for baseball, and, you know, John, you did a great job in this book, and it's interesting to read things like Weaver managed 22 different 20-win pitchers, including four of Weaver's pitchers, Mike Queller, Jim Palmer, Mike Flanagan, and Steve Sohn, who won six Cy Youngs. And no Oriole won it before Weaver, and no one has won it after. Like, these are interesting facts that show how good he was. Let me ask you this question. I know I just ratted some stuff off, but, like, who did you speak to the most about this book?
As a source?
Yeah, like, which person did you feel like you got something from them and you had to go back and keep getting more from them?
Probably Ken Singleton, the former Yankees broadcaster, too, for your listeners. I mean, he was so helpful, and the Orioles were not very cooperative. I mean, I think they, under Angelos at least, the former owner, they didn't like talking about people who were there before they were, and they were kind of defensive, and maybe they were worried I was going to talk too much about the drinking, so they were not helping me. But Ken Singleton welcomed me for a long lunch down in Florida where he lives, and gave me all these extra sources and numbers, and would check facts with me. He was very helpful. Rick Dempsey, the former catcher, was very helpful. The family was very helpful. I mean, it speaks well that, you know, his kids, even though he was on the road a lot and, you know, essentially neglected or abandoned them for years because he was away doing baseball, which is the fate of a lot of baseball marriages, a lot of baseball families, they kind of forgave him, and they were very charming and very helpful and sweet. And so I really came to appreciate the Weavers as they gave me more material. I mean, I found, like, pictures of Earl when he's 4 years old swinging a bat, which is really hilarious, and picture of him at his first communion when he's like 9 years old in the Lutheran church. I mean, all this stuff I never would have gotten without the family helping me out. So, yeah, Singleton, Dempsey, and the Weaver family were the most helpful.
One last one for you from me. The psychology of his players, the way he talked to his players, can you give our listeners a little bit into what you put in the book about how he dealt with his players in that way?
Yeah, so he didn't want to be their friends. He knew that was a boundary. He was not, you know, touchy or warm and cuddly. He was somebody who had high expectations, but he also didn't hold grudges. And so they loved playing for him in the end because he wasn't a political type of leader. He was a leader who cared about the most important stuff, winning the games, playing correct baseball, throwing strikes, making plays. You know, I coach high school baseball, and I say this kind of stuff to my baseball players. And he had this kind of pure focus where he would chew you out, and the next day he would be forgotten. He wouldn't hold a grudge. And so, and he pushed players to be the best they could be to try to win the games. He really cared about the games. And there's a hilarious anecdote where Don Baylor, one of his hitters, got hit by this pitcher, Dick Tidrow. And Weaver walked up and down the dugout for the rest of the game going, "Tidrow, I hope you get hit by a truck next summer or next winter," which is an insane thing to say. But it showed how much he cared about the players. And he would do things like if the player had, you know, four RBIs to get to a certain level where he'd get a bonus in his contract, he would play the guy, you know, give him extra playing time to help him get those bonus numbers. And so that care and concern for his players, for winning the games, that's how he led. And it sort of made the other stuff, like the drinking and the stuff I talked about before, not as relevant because he, again, this focus on winning the games for the sake of winning, not trying to, you know, aggrandize his own ego. He wasn't into, like, taking credit, really. He would say, it's the players who win the games, not me.
The book is The Last Manager, How Earl Weaver Tricked, Tormented, and Reinvented Baseball. John W. Miller is the author. John, thank you so much for joining us. You really you gave us a great background on how you wrote the book. Chris and I both read it. It's a wonderful read. We highly recommend it for any sports fan, especially baseball fan. And again, thanks so much and continued success. Are you working on anything else at the moment?
I appreciate you guys having me on. I'm not. I have a 10-month-old son. So
that's enough.
Trying to keep him happy and fed. And, if another book comes along, I'll jump on it, but not for another couple of years.
Well, enjoy
coaching,
yeah,
too.
Exactly.
It's a fun
Absolutely.
Time.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate you guys.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for joining us. That's John W. Miller. Great book, and just, you know what? It's great to see, even after the time since it's been published, Cap, he really, you can tell he enjoyed writing the book, and you can almost hear him smiling through the microphone, because it was a labor of love, it seems like.
You know, it's kind of interesting. Like, think about if you were told, we'd like to give you some money, Mike, to write a book, and you could kind of choose from somebody who, you know, past or present, still alive or dead, you know, that you would want to write the book about. And I think, you know, for him, he chose Earl Weaver, and as he said, he got some backlash from the Orioles. Like, they didn't want this stuff out there, but he was able to get a lot from other people, and it winds up being a good read. There's a lot of people in there that put some quotes in there that make you read it.
Yeah, I'd heard that the Orioles were kind of a weird organization like that. With
forgot with the Peter Angelos.
He was a very interesting character in terms of keeping things close to the vest with that team, but. You know, that's what made the franchise interesting. I mean, have they really been even relevant?
Yeah. Well, let's think about this before we take a break, too. You know, if you were to say, oh, a Mets manager, do you think of a Mets manager as doing some of the stuff that he did? You know, Bobby Valentine with, like, a mustache. Like, you know, you don't think of Willie Randolph as being that or Art Howe or, you know, even, like, Buck Showalter was a little more like, I'm in charge and I'm going to help this turn around this franchise.
Terry Collins had a little bit of
Terry
him,
had
I think.
Some of that, you know.
You know, when you hear that, Tommy, you got to give us a shot.
You got to give us a shot.
Yeah, and who knows how much more there would have been from
but
any
I think
of these
a lot
guys,
of these guys are a little more, you know, I just got to be there and just put the same lineup out there and whatever. You know, I don't think the Orioles are looking at Brandon Hyde saying this guy, you know, is going to go out there and fake like he's taking a grenade and throwing it on the mound by picking up, you know, one of those things. So I think it's an interesting read to talk about a guy who just laid it all out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the second half hour, we're going to be joined by John Santamaria, going to talk a little Islanders hockey, and then we're going to finish up tonight with former New York Jet Kenny Schroy, who's going to talk about the Marty
Mike, I'm going to tease with a little trivia in case anybody
Let's
wants
do
to
it.
Call in.
All right.
There are 25 players in the Basketball Hall of Fame who also coached in the NBA as a coach.
Okay.
So they got in as a player. Can you guess how many of them also then got in later as a coach? So 25 players who coached in the NBA and were in the Hall of Fame, how many of them also got in later as a coach?
That's a fantastic question. If you want to call in, 516-623-1240 on the other side. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with more Sports Talk New York on WGBB.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to this second half hour of Sports Talk New York here on Long Island's WGBB 95.9 FM, 1240 AM. The number is 516-623-1240 if you'd like to call in. If you have an answer to the trivia question or want to talk a little Earl Weaver or any sports in New York, we're going to be joined in just a moment by John Santamaria to talk a little New York Islanders hockey and perhaps a moment or two of the Jets. And then Kenny Schroy, who was a former New York Jet. Again, you know, just quickly, not to belabor the point, but here we are today, another Giant collapse and a Jet win. Dare we say a winning streak for the New York Jets?
That's going to be tough. But here's the thing, Mike. We come into the studio and, you know, last time you were throwing your water bottle up against the fence when the field goal went through for the other team. But
I was getting ready for basketball season.
Yep. But, you know, Mike, like, it's four collapses for the Giants now. I mean.
And that night, they were going to fire him coming off the plane, Brian Daboll, apparently.
Yeah.
Did he make it off the tarmac tonight, do you think?
I mean, I don't know. You have to put this one. I didn't really watch it. I'm not going to say it was. I have to put this blame on Daboll, because once your star quarterback goes out, you got to find a way to finish the game. Right. And he didn't. And obviously, you're putting. Let's be honest. Russell Wilson stinks. He absolutely stinks.
Yeah.
But you can't go three plays and negative 8 yards. You got to find a way to finish that game. They gave up two touchdowns in like 2 minutes.
Yeah, and I didn't quite get it. I mean, again, I'm not a football play caller, nor do I profess to be one at any time. But they go play action first play. Why not just hand the ball off? You know, even if you're going to eat a little time, just odd calls. I mean, you could tell that the Giants, they looked like they were going to lose the game.
I just feel like he has no feel.
Yeah.
And to not be winning. I mean, there's probably now four games that the Giants could have won and put themselves in a situation where they're around 500, maybe even above.
Yeah.
And winning games in their division, and they just are not. And you just feel like, you know, like you just feel things after a while. Like once it happens once or twice, you feel that collapse coming.
Oh, absolutely.
And now you're like, you know what, we're done. And that's a bad feeling.
It is. You know, Jackson Dart, he's definitely given them a boost of energy. The kid can play. The only thing is he's going to
put himself.
Yeah, and he's going to get hurt.
There.
Yeah, I mean, he cannot continue to play at this kind of level, of putting himself in harm's way and have any kind of career.
And I think, unfortunately for the Giants, the rest of the year, especially if they lose another game here or there, the fans are just not going to be into it. If Jackson Dart's out and Scatabu's out and your wide receiver is out, like, there's really not any young talent that you're going to watch.
No.
Those games are going to become unwatchable, and we'll talk to A.J. Rovner about that in a couple of weeks and see where they're at. But that's really hard, Mike.
What do you think? What is the benefit of keeping Russell Wilson on the team right now? I mean,
what's the benefit of keeping Jameis Winston on the team?
Well, the only thing with Jameis Winston, I think he signed a 2-year contract.
He wants to be there,
says
it.
And he does, and I think that he's keenly aware and has accepted his role. You know,
okay.
There's lots of video of him you know, pre-post game meeting with the kids. Like the guy can play. He's certainly not any worse than Russell Wilson right now. You know, Russ, maybe there was no takers for him whatsoever, but I mean, he has no future at all with the team. Maybe they had a gentleman's agreement. Hey, look, we're not going to cut you. We'll keep it for the season. I don't know. It's just an odd situation, because Jackson Dart, you know, he's so superior right now as a rookie to a guy who really most likely will be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, two rushing touchdowns today before getting injured. That's a tough spot for them. I don't know why Russell Wilson's still on a team. I didn't like the move to begin
with.
Yeah,
it didn't make sense.
I was just like, why would you bring in a guy like that? It's just not what they need at this time. But maybe, I don't know, maybe Daboll was trying to save his job with a veteran as opposed to putting a young kid in there.
But they had to figure that they were going to draft somebody. I mean, it just, I don't know.
Well, I think at this point, you know, if the Giants lose more games, I think that's better. You know, I think it's
it puts
them in a situation where they don't have to worry about, you know, are we going to be middle of the pack and a middle of the pack draft pick? They don't have to rush Dart back. I just think for Daboll's situation, it's coming down to wins and losses. If for some way the Giants, with whoever as quarterback, are able to show some life and win like 5 out of the next 7 games to kind of finish the season off, maybe he keeps his job. But I just think it's time for a new direction. Now, the question would then be, do they both go, Shane and Daboll, or just one?
I'm not a big proponent of people losing their jobs. I mean, I just hate it, especially in
agreed.
But I think you got to start it over. I mean, what?
But you can't start with another coordinator that you think you're going to catch fire in a bottle.
Yeah, no.
It would have to be somebody that you go get from somewhere else that maybe has done it before. I'm not talking about Bill Belichick.
Well, that's, you know, ironically enough, his name was came up. But would he be able right now, Bill Belichick, to survive in New York with the clown show that he's become?
My God. With his girlfriend hanging out with Cam Scataboo? No, not happening. I don't think that's going to work here. I think that ship has passed. I don't know if he could still do it in the NFL. I really don't.
Well, you want to know something interesting? The Giants lose a game to the Denver Broncos.
Ugh, that was rough.
Right? They lose that game. As you said, and when I threw my water bottle against the fence, but I didn't hit anybody. There was no one else in the parking lot.
No refs in the way.
But did you hear after the game some of the quotes from the Denver Broncos head coach? What did he?
Yeah, I think there was like, was there a message intended for Russell Wilson, or was it just, you know, the young kid was playing pretty well?
But also, if you listen, he talks about how much he respects the Giants organization.
Yes. He was there.
Yeah. Would he, you know, he's doing great in Denver.
No.
I'm just throwing it. It was just odd to me. You know, I think these guys are so calculated that they always want to be on great terms with everybody because they know they're one bad season away from being out the door or maybe later on. But the New York Giant job, it used to be such a headliner, and they've gone through kind of this collection of stiffs.
Yeah.
You know, Pat Shermer, God bless him.
Oh, gosh.
I can't even remember the other guy who couldn't wear a suit that fit.
We had the special teams guy we brought in for a year. The Giants have gone through coaches.
Yeah, this is the New York Giants.
Yeah, and a lot of the people that they've brought in are just not the players, not the coaches that you want. Once again, on trivia question, there were 25 NBA players who made the Hall of Fame as players. How many of them also made it in as a coach? I was talking with Mike during the break there were a couple. So there's definitely more than one. And we bring that up for reasons. I tried to get a couple of guests on Richie Adubato.
Yeah.
Richie Adubato was a big-time coach. And I think he really reinvigorated women's basketball here in New York, as well as being an assistant to Hubie Brown with the New York Knicks.
Yeah, Richie Adubato was one of the first really well-known male coaches who came over to the WNBA, and he did a fantastic job with the Liberty. Not that the league needed legitimizing, if that's the word, the proper word, but he really, you know, he came in and did that. Just, you know, he was a well-known, as you said, well-known, fantastic coach. Goes way back with Dick Vitale.
Yeah.
Local guy.
Yeah.
Him,
Hubie Brown, Mike Fratello.
Yeah.
Dick Vitale, all like the New Jersey guys. And I really thought that he was a good coach. Wasn't afraid to be an assistant as well as, you know, did well as a head coach and was well respected by people like Teresa Weatherspoon and Rebecca Lobo, and Kim Hampton was another one that shined with the Liberty. And it didn't have to be with just the men. He did it with the women. And I thought that that's not easy because you think of like people like Bill Laimbeer. He tried to do that with both sports too.
Yep.
It's not always easy.
No, it's not. And that whole group that you were mentioning with Vitale and, Fratello, though, that group of coaches from that time frame, those were the five-star camp guys. Those were they would sit in a restaurant and draw stuff on a napkin all night long and talk to each other. They'd do a clinic any place. They would drive to the Peoria, Illinois to talk basketball just because they love the game.
Yeah.
And, hopefully that continues. But that generation, slowly but surely, unfortunately, is we're losing these guys and
today
women.
Today was Lenny Wilkins.
Yes, yeah, a tough day as well. Lenny Wilkins, I never had the pleasure of meeting him, but he just seemed like a class guy.
Yeah. And he did it as a player and as a coach, and I just thought, like,
there's an answer to your trivia question.
Yep. I just thought he dealt with the young people as well as some of the veterans and did a great job promoting the game as well. And it's very hard to have that situation where you look at these coaches be there long term, like a Greg Popovich. A lot of these guys wind up moving on. One of the guys that I like watching is Billy Donovan now, just kind of watching him grow from a Long Island guy, made the Hall of Fame, did college, now does it in the pros. And I kind of watch those guys. Can they do it at different levels? Can they do it at maybe high school, college, and pro? Can they do it with the women's game and the men's game? Because to me, that kind of shows that you have the versatility to change. You don't just have one system, and I don't mean to put it this way, but like a Patino Calipari, it's like, this is the way I'm going to do it, and I'm going to be stubborn, and it's the only way I'm going to do it. And it doesn't work at the pro level just the way it works at the college level. So I just thought it was interesting to bring that up. But
yeah, and guys like Lenny Wilkins, you know, the game of basketball when they were in the NBA, it was so different. You know, no 3-point line, you know, very slow pace. He was able to kind of change with the times. And, you know, he won with the Supersonics, Seattle Supersonics team back in the late 70s, one style, and then brought the Hawks back to kind of respectability. And I was really disappointed. I loved it when he was the Knicks coach, and it just didn't work out for him. But I thought that was a great move. I was just so happy to have a person of his stature coaching the team at that point.
Yeah, interesting. At this time of the year, you know, the NBA is starting. I think people are going to start to ask questions about how legit the Knicks are. The Nets are horrendous.
By design?
It could be.
Well, they got three of their Porter. Yeah, but I was going to say they have three of their five first round picks playing in the G League.
Yeah, you got the kid from Michigan. I don't know.
Can you get any worse?
I really don't. Good don't Lord. I don't understand that.
If you were going to hold on to all five picks, right? Wouldn't you figure let's just throw them to the Wolves in the NBA? I mean,
yeah.
Why not? I guess there was no package to be had. They're just an odd franchise. Do you see him long term in Brooklyn?
That's a good question.
I think they tried. They gave it a good shot.
They tried to do that big three.
Yeah.
And that didn't work. And honestly, since then, there really has been no pickup. It's been bad. Like,
no.
To try to pick up from something like that when you give up all your draft picks to somebody else, you know, they wound up getting back some draft picks, but then you didn't do much with it. But they're going to be second class citizens in New York for a long time.
Yeah. And, you know, filling that building down there in Brooklyn, the NBA, you can only have it so many times where people are coming to watch the opponent. You know, you got to have something.
Yeah, people aren't going to come to watch LeBron James in his last year out half the game.
Yeah, I mean, because if the team is so bad, guys are going to want to take a night off when they come because they're more than likely going to go play the Knicks or Philly or somebody else. And why bust their chops against Brooklyn? You know, when probably, you know, me, you, Brian, and maybe two people we can find down the street right now could at least give them a half.
Yeah.
It's really rough. You know, just real quick on the Islanders, we were waiting on Johnny, but I guess he had something up tonight. Big win last night, 5-0 over the Rangers. The Rangers, can't score a goal at home.
At home.
I think they're 0-7-1 at home.
That would have been the bet last night. If you really wanted to go out there, Rangers were favored. Imagine if, you took that bet where you took the Islanders and the shutout. Yeah, that would have been great.
And the Rangers brought back all these guys and, you know, big, you know, celebration, and the Islanders just stuck it to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, not.
They're getting there.
The Islanders are
getting there. Schneider's good.
Yeah, he is. And he's putting a little life into the team, into the building. They're faster. Their goaltending's been a little up and down with Sorokin, but, there's a future there. Cal Ritchie, who they got in the trade earlier in the year, he's a big kid. He's gonna be real good. That team's exciting.
Yep, it's gonna be fun.
Yeah. So now we're gonna bring in someone that you're very familiar with. Love for you to do the intro on this one.
We're gonna welcome in now Kenny Schroy. Kenny, thanks for joining us, Chris and Mike here on WGBB Radio. How's everything going?
Everything's great. How are you guys doing?
All right,
doing good, Kenny. Thanks.
So, yeah, Kenny and I know each other, but at the same time, Kenny, you are a co-founder of the Marty Lyons Foundation, and I know you guys are doing good things for kids. Whenever something goes down, you guys are there to pick people up, and you have a mission, and when some kid has a wish, you guys are there. So can you talk a little bit about how you and Marty started this foundation, you know, way back when you guys were playing in the 70s and the 80s?
Way back when, we had a player's bulletin board, and different foundations would ask us to come and, you know, participate in other functions, whatever it may be, or come visit the kids at the hospital, or you know, whatever it might be, come to a Christmas party. So, and I used to volunteer. I always thought it was good to volunteer, and I came in earlier than Marty did. When Marty was drafted in 1979, I believe, all of a sudden he started putting his name on that list too. And, we just kind of became really good friends and then started going to all these, fundraisers and whatever we could do because we just, thought helping the community was the right thing to do. And we especially got hooked on the Leukemia Society. I mean, those kids were just going through all kinds of hell, and you know, they were just so sweet. And Marty became friends with a little boy by the name of Keith, and you know, Keith was just really cool. And you know, his parents were blaming each other for his illness, and anyway, Marty kind of was the buffer there, and he stayed in contact with Keith. And unfortunately, you know, Keith passed away. First, his father passed away of a heart attack, and his son was born, and then Keith passed away. And those three particular things that happened to Marty, you know, he just thought he had to do something more. So he caught me, and we were roommates, you know, when we were playing with the Jets, and good friends. And he asked me if I would help him start a foundation, and I said, sure, whatever you want, because we were doing, you know, foundation, I mean, kids work anyway, you know, except for foundation. So I said, sure, let's do it. And as long as I wasn't in the name, it was all Marty Lyons Foundation. So, you know, we started then. It was the two of us. Before you knew it, it was six of us. And then we went on from there and started growing and having fundraisers. And before you know it, we have 13 chapters in 13 states, I believe it is. And, you know, we helped 8,700 children with their special wishes. And you know, when you meet these children, they're getting their wishes. It's sad, but yet they are so excited to see you know, it's just it's something that always was to me higher on the totem pole than football was at the time. So you know, you're looking at kids that are, you know, fighting for their lives. So it was very humbling. But, you know, it kept me down on earth. And, you know, I got to play football with the Jets, although some years weren't so good. you know, the Jets were very supportive of Marty and the foundation. So, you know, it was a real good time, when this all happened.
Again, we're joined by Kenny Schroy. Kenny, this is Mike Quinone. Thanks for joining us tonight. You brought up your time with the Jets. You played for them from 77 to 84. Kind of an evolution of the team, you know, from playing at Shea Stadium. And can you talk a little bit just about your time with the Jets and, you know, some memorable moments or even memorable teammates, obviously, other than Marty, who you're very close with?
Yeah, well, I actually signed with the Jets in 1976, and that's when Joe Namath was still there.
Okay.
And I broke an ankle, you know, so wow. I couldn't play, but I was on injury reserve, and I got to watch Joe and get to know him, and the Jets were so bad, and Joe Namath could not move,
yeah.
And I said, holy mackerel, you know, that could have happened to me if you keep playing too long. But, you know, Joe moved on, I was traded, and we got Richard Todd, and Walt Michaels came in and started building the team. You know, he started with the offensive and defensive lines first, and which was the right thing to do, and of course the sack exchange kind of ruled back then, and I've been very fortunate to be a strong safety behind them, and it was a blast. Believe me, it was a blast.
So, Kenny, this Thursday, it's the fourth annual Evening of Thanks Gala. You know, you guys do some bowl-a-thons, and this gala is in its fourth year. Usually, Marty finds a special live wish to reveal, and it's going to be at the Bourne Mansion. If anybody wants, go to the MartyLyonsFoundation.org and look it up. You know, what's kind of like the special moments for you at events like this?
Well, you know, we invite a lot of past recipient children and their families, and sometimes, you know, ones that are probably going to get a wish from us, you know, down the road, could be months, but, you know, we invite a lot of them. And there's always a reveal that night, and what's nice about it all are long-time supporters come to this, and then everybody else who comes to it, they say it's such a nice event because what Marty does and says, and the things that go on, and the food, and, you know, the silent auction. It's just a real nice time to just mingle. And so, and then when they do the live reveal, the child doesn't know it's coming, and it's pretty cool. They keep it, you know, secretive, and the child doesn't know until that night. So that's pretty cool to see. And, yeah, stuff like that, Marty loves doing. It's wonderful to see that. It's wonderful to be a part of it.
Well, this year it's at the Bourne Mansion, so I hope you get a good look at the menu, because you're going to have another invite in April to JJ and Corey's wedding, which is going to be at the same place. So
yes, it is. I know.
So we'll have to keep that one on the burner and see how good the food is. But, you know, honestly, just everything that you guys do, there's got to be moments for you where it just kind of almost becomes too much, and the emotion probably just becomes too much from seeing what some of these kids have to go through.
Well, it used to be that way. No doubt about it. I've had a very difficult time. I know going to my very first funeral, which was Keith, Marty was unfortunately down at his father's funeral, and I asked my wife Susan to come with me because it's something I haven't experienced. And I knew Keith. I went to see him a bunch of times, and I went to that funeral, and didn't really like it at all. But you know, I had to say my goodbyes. And we've been to, Marty and I have been to so many of them. Many of them Marty spoke, and you know, it's just so unfair that these children didn't have a full life. So. If we can put a smile on their face for a while, that's what we try to do, and that's what the Marty Lyons Foundation is all about. So, yeah, it's really cool meeting these kids. You would never know they're sick, some of them. Some of them you do, some of them you don't. But they're all going through the same thing. They're all trying to survive, and you know, we're trying to help them with a little bit of a smile.
Kenny, are any of the current day Jets or the organization involved in terms of the foundation itself and you know, kind of contributing or sending a player or showing up?
Well, no, they always contribute. Yeah. There's always that. They've always supported the Marty Lyons Foundation. And we try to get a guy a lot of times, you know, to be like our spokesperson for the team. I'm not sure if Marty found one for this year yet or not. But we did have one. He got traded, so you know, we really wanted to see who we're going to get. I mean, everybody seems to be getting traded or cut or
yeah. I think they traded the water boy
right
week.
Now. So we're kind of sitting back and watching, just like everybody else. You know?
So Kenny, for those who don't know, your involvement with the Jets now and kind of watching them, you know, and what you're up to, you know, as well as a father, as a grandfather, what's going on with you and what's your involvement with the Jets as you now are many years past your playing days?
Well, you know, when you first retired, you were still known. So we did it. They were always inviting us over to help entertain the suites, you might call it.
Okay.
And I used to go to every game, and they would pay you for doing this. And I go to every game, and I did that for I don't know how many years. You know, and after a while, you know, the younger guys are going to replace the older guys. So, you know, and that happens. It's no big deal. But we still get together once a year, all, you know, as many that's still alive, who played no matter what year you played, and it's alumni weekend, and they're going to have it again this year, and we're going to be missing a lot of players, unfortunately, but a lot of new ones will be added, you know, guys that retired recently or last few years. So, you know, it's good to kind of meet everybody, and we kind of all went through the same stuff, and it's a good night.
Kenny, before we let you go, you had mentioned Joe Namath, and I'm a huge Joe Namath fan. I just, you know, I'm in my late 50s, and when I first started watching football, you know, my dad was a huge Jets fan. Was he as amazing and larger than life, should I say, in person as he was, like, you know, from the TV set? Was he really that big of a personality?
Well, you know, as a teammate of his, no, not really. Yeah. He's just one of the guys.
Just wanted to play, right?
I mean, when we're around, you know, just the guys, he's one of the guys. It was not a big deal, but it was funny when we went to games and or away games, they would, like, part the water. I mean, it was like, gosh, here comes Joe Namath. And I always thought that to be funny, because the poor guy had, you know, pretty much lost his arm, and you know, I felt bad for him. You know, when he went in to perform, and he couldn't really anymore.
Yeah.
So you know, but other than that, he was just a great guy, and yeah, it was great being around a person like that. And to this day, I still know him. I still see him once in a while. We still give each other a hug. So yeah, just a good guy.
That's great.
Once again, this Thursday, November 13th, at the Bourne Mansion, the fourth annual evening of Thanks Gala for the Marty Lyons Foundation and our Brave Wish children. Kenny, once again, we thank you for everything that you do. Your wife, Susan, Marty Lyons, you guys do so much for the kids, and I think every year it just makes more and more of a difference. So thank you for coming on, and thank you for all you do.
Well, thank you, and I hope the listeners come on down. The more, the merrier. All right. I appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. All right.
Kenny Schroyer, thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. And you know what, Cap, I'll tell you just quickly before I know we're up against it here. Many, many years ago when I first started teaching at Holy Child, where I met you, and this is like, you know, early 90s, someone I worked with was very close with Marty and always told me about him and, you know, what a great guy he was and the foundation, and they would go all the time. And to think of, you know, really 34, 35 years later, it's still going strong. It's sad in one way that they have to do it.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, just the thousands and thousands of kids and families that they've helped. And a guy like Kenny Schroyer, who he said all he wanted to do was help. He didn't want his name on it, which is amazing.
Yeah, he wanted it to be Marty Lyons. But also, whenever something comes up, him and Marty just say, let's get it done. Yeah. If there's a kid that's in need, they get it done. And, you know, for me, my kids grow up kind of knowing him as Uncle Kenny, and it's just great. He's just a great person, great family. And what they're doing for people and kids and families alike, Mike, they'll just take a kid and say, what's your favorite thing? What do you like to do? And they'll just go make a dream out of it.
Yeah.
If the kid wants to fly airplanes, they take him in an airplane and fly him to a place. It's just amazing the things that they can do. And, you know, Marty is no longer doing the announcing for the Jets.
Right.
But he does put his time and effort into helping kids out. So
There's a great example of taking your professional athlete career and making something more of it. I mean, You certainly can't ask for anything more from a player. That's a role model. You know, we could go on and on about, you know, the other side of it, but and we make fun of, you know, the losing and the Jets and different things, but you know, there's so many great things that happen from organizations and guys. So great to have them on. Thanks also, John W. Miller. He was fantastic. Go buy the book. It's available on Amazon, wherever books are sold.
Trivia answer was 5.
Okay.
And we'll be back in a couple of weeks. Hopefully we'll have some good guests as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully we'll have a couple more wins under our belt here in the football thing. For Brian Gray's Mind of Glass, Chris Caputo, I'm Mike Wadone. Thanks so much. We'll see you in a couple of weeks, everybody.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.